Welcome to the SDF conferencing system. There are two other parties in this conference.
All right.
You go, Jasmine.
Okay, this is Jasmine.
All right.
Time for Open VoIP on AnonRadio.net, and tonight is our vintage comp or vintage computer talk with me, Jazzmaz, and SMJ.
Yes.
And tonight, who are we going to be hearing from?
Well, we have a special guest tonight, Tamiko Thiel, or Thiel, depending on where you are in the world. And she will correct us on that. But she is our guest, and because she's in Munich, this is a pre-recorded interview that happened yesterday morning, early Seattle time. She's also a local Seattleite who is now, of course, living in Munich, Germany. And her background, she'll go into detail about this, which is just amazing to be around Xerox PARC, Stanford AI Lab, MIT AI Lab, and just, you know, not as a computer programmer, but
right, just the culture in general. Right?
Yeah, and she describes how she, why she wanted to be in those circles, and it's a lot of fun. And of course, she is, I guess, most notably famous for the CM1, CM2 connection machine, which Thinking Machines put out in very small numbers. And then, of
right, they were generations of supercomputers as an actual commercial product, right? As an outgrowth of all the work that was going on in the general academic area.
Yeah. So there's some details in that, and you know, the question is, how the heck does somebody who is studying product design in this kind of mechanical engineering, how the heck does somebody get hooked up with the cutting edge? And so I think it's interesting. This is part one, and it covers the majority of the connection machine up to it being used in a MoMA exhibit, so she'll talk a little bit about that.
Nice.
Yeah. So, and it's just under 40 minutes long, so we have some time, and I thought, well, what's coming up next? Well, of course, we've got Robert Bernardo. He's going to make another appearance.
He's going to be another regular on the on the vintage comp.
Hello,
yeah.
on radio listeners.
Right.
Coming
and
up next hour is a free open time slot. Are you creative and reliable? Then why not become a DJ and support on radio? Come on, it's not that you have anything better to do. I know,
talk about
right?
Everything and anything. Since
right,
we haven't spoken in a long time.
Yeah, and so he followed up and he said, "Oh, I've got all these people you can talk to, and I'm going to set them all up." And he's like, "I already got Bill Hurd," and I'm like, "Oh, okay." So, another person I talked to today that I thought would be really good to include. And I'm not talking about the one we just talked about, because that is a secret. That's a deep state secret. Yeah.
That will be a surprise if it comes to fruition.
It certainly will be a surprise, won't it? The person I talked to today who's interested in doing this is a former Moog music clinician who used to run the trade shows with Bob Moog. And he's a performer, he would do the performances on the mini Moog back in the day.
Sure.
when Moog Music was trying to, you know, hey,
yeah,
you
make a space
a
for
Moog?
Itself. Yeah.
You want to buy a mini Moog? I don't know. Does anybody want to buy a mini Moog? But
I don't know. What does it sound like? What's it like to play on?
So he's got some interesting stories, and then. But the connection to Vintage Comp is that he then went on to work with Dave Smith of Sequential Circuits. And Sequential Circuits is the manufacturer of maybe not the first, but probably the most notorious Zilog 80-based analog synthesizer, the Prophet 5.
Right.
And, yeah. So
as well as a producer of many other MIDI products that trickled their way down into the home computer world as well, for that matter, right?
Right, right. And John even describes that early MIDI standard that, one of the guys from Devo, or at least a brother of one of the Devo guys, was involved in, that Fob Mothers bought, I guess it is. That the first version of MIDI that was used with the I guess it's the Prophet 600 and the Roland Jupiter 6 is actually what Sequential was calling MIDI or pre-MIDI MIDI.
Yeah.
Pre-MIDI, which was their early attempt.
Right, before there was anything really standardized.
Right.
Yeah. Computer-controlled musical instruments.
So that's really exciting. And then he said, hey, I've got an Amiga 2000. Do you want an Amiga 2000? I was just like, maybe. anywho, he will be interesting to talk to. And then, of course, he has a project regarding a new synthesizer that he's been working on with that makes use of some of the vintage stuff, some secrets maybe he will divulge. It's already a released product that uses the wavetable stuff and the Prophet VS waveforms. But he has some new things that are going to be incorporated as part of an upgrade that you can install as a consumer.
Sounds exciting.
It sounds exciting. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to mute the conference bridge, and I'm going to bring up this audio. Sorry, I have to hear my echo. Of the interview with Tamiko Thiel from yesterday. I guess it was yesterday. Jeez.
Yeah, okay. I know. Everything is sort of a whirlwind, right?
Right. So here you guys go. I mean, this is a real treat. So
yeah,
enjoy.
I'm looking forward to hearing it.
All right.
Are we muted now?
I think so.
Are we playing?
It's playing, yeah. I'm on the sound stream. Oh, crap.
Oh,
we're not
there
muted.
You are. Okay. My name is Tamiko Thiel, and I am now a media artist. But
enjoy.
In 1983 to 1985, I was the lead designer on the team that did the product design for the connection machines CM1 and CM2 supercomputers.
If we start with the connection machine specifically and how you got involved in that, I mean, I know a bit about your background and what you studied in, but it's kind of pretty much ahead of your time. If you're at the cutting edge of technology and art, at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I did not study artificial intelligence. The way I got involved in the connection machine was simply that when I was a graduate student at MIT in the early 80s, 81 to 83, one of my primary social groups was the MIT AI lab. I was actually studying in the mechanical engineering department, but as I always say, the AI lab parties were more fun. Actually, I don't think I ever went to an ME party, but and I got hooked up with the MIT AI lab people because when I was in when I was working at Hewlett-Packard as a product designer in Silicon Valley in 79, 80, my boyfriend at the time, Gene McDaniel, was at Xerox PARC. So I knew, you know, I was in their social circles and in their wine tasting circles. And when they found out I was going to MIT for grad school, they said, oh, you should, like, get to know my friend Danny Hillis and Marvin Minsky over at the MIT AI lab. So I landed in Boston with recommendations to look them up. And somehow I struck up an immediate friendship with Danny and like I said, went to a lot of parties, and, you know, some of them in the basement of Marvin's big house, which is where Danny Hillis was living with Margaret Minsky, Marvin's daughter. They were together at that time, living together in the basement. So, you know, so I hung out there, and when I graduated, like 3 days after the graduation ceremony in June of 1983, all of a sudden Danny called me up and said, you know, I'm starting a company to actually build the machine that I'm designing for my doctoral thesis. And since I know that you worked as a product design engineer at Hewlett-Packard, I'm wondering if you'd come to join the company. I was employee number 10, and do the product design. So he took me out to the Robert Treat Paine house that they had just rented over in Waltham, where they were recabling the whole house, because this is like a 19th century building that was going to have massive power going in and out for all of the list machines. You know, each one of the software people and probably the hardware people also was working on a workstation. So they had to literally rewire the entire house. And in the hot summers, we kept on taking down the power net in the area. So Danny took me out and showed me the house, which is on 11 acres of woods, and said, and the best thing is, if you come and work for us, you get to work with Richard Feynman. And I said, where do I sign? So it was really that informal, and, you know, that's the typical power of going to a place like MIT, where, you know, the people you just hang out with do really interesting things.
That is actually really amazing. I didn't know the details of that. But before you got to MIT, you were studying industrial design, I guess,
product design, actually, because industrial design, at least then, I think the categories have shifted somewhat, but industrial design back in those days was essentially was essentially the aesthetics and the look of products. And product design back in those days, I was at the Stanford product design program, and back in those days, it was a joint program with between the sort of art design and mechanical engineering departments, and I was just like two classes short of also getting an ME degree. And I was more focused on sort of human factors and sort of the mechanical side of things. So, which back in those days, at least, was very different from the focus on aesthetics and form that was industrial design.
So, when you're at MIT working on your master's degree, and you have access to the AI lab.
I mean, not in a technical sense. I literally just hung out at their parties.
Oh,
I really
just socially. Okay.
Yeah. I was a social groupie.
Oh, I see. I would think that things that were happening in the AI lab, I mean, they've already built up a reputation going back a couple of decades at that point. In the late 70s, early 80s, it's almost, you know, two decades of AI lab and the Railroad and all that stuff.
Right.
Did you get to use any of the computers or the ITS operating system that they were working on?
No, I was also not so much of a programmer. I mean, it turns out that my master's project in the ME department biomechanical lab was a programming project, but you know, I took like one Pascal class and then one assembly class, and then you know, when I was a freshman at Stanford, my freshman advisor was a physicist at Slack, so he gave me a summer job there and then handed me a reference Fortran reference book and said, here, learn how to program. And my first question was, what is a program? So, you know, I did not study computer science. I sort of picked up some programming kind of because, you know, every engineering student has to. But when I was hanging out at Xerox PARC, they had the Altos, they had Windows and the mouse at a point when no one else had it. But I also didn't have access there because my my boyfriend would always go, "We have the mouse and Windows, and you don't get to use it." You know, so it's like, you know, I read stories where other artists said, you know, they were sneaking me in nights and weekends so I could play around on their altos, and you know, my direct contact was telling me I couldn't. So it's like, so you know, another friend of mine was on back in those days was Joanna Hoffman on the first Macintosh team. She couldn't tell us that she was working on the Macintosh because it was a secret project at that time, and she actually only told me in hushed tones when she came out to visit me in, I think, 82 at MIT. But you know, of course, you know, I was hanging out with these people and with the people who designed the Ethernet, and so everyone's like talking about computers. And then, you know, when I go and hang out at the MIT AI lab, people are also talking about computers. So basically, although I didn't have any background in programming, because of my social groups in both Silicon Valley and at MIT, I had been essentially hanging out with these computer research groups at Xerox PARC, Apple, MIT AI lab from 79 until Danny asked me to join the company that he had just started in 83. So, you know, and I must say, taking an assembler class was really key because, you know, you're sitting there saying, okay, you know, shift register, right? And you're dealing with binary. And the that one assembler class that I took gave me enough background. So when I was at Thinking Machines and people were talking about, you know, the ALU and shift registers and stuff like that, I knew not only sort of conceptually, but I had also, you know, I'd worked with those sorts of things. So I had personal experience with that really low level of computer architecture, even though, you know, I didn't actually use it in my work per se.
Yeah, I can imagine just being around it. Human beings are clever, and we pick up on things and we recognize patterns. And sooner or later, it's through osmosis, you're going to be one of the clubs, so to speak. But that is just so amazing to be so close in those years to what was going on at Stanford and Xerox PARC, and then at MIT. Even just as a user, not necessarily a programmer, there was some interesting things and concepts like email and even what people would consider the birth of instant messaging.
I got my first email in 1979 while I was still in the Bay Area, because like everybody I knew had email. I mean, everyone at PARC or whatever had email. I actually didn't have email at Hewlett Packard, but then I think a friend of mine at PARC said, "Oh, you know, I can get you an account through MIT because they have these like ghost accounts that they set up." So I was on email from 79. And when I, you know, when I first arrived at MIT, I'm looking for a terminal, and we are talking about Selectric terminals. We are not talking about CRTs. A terminal where I could read my email. I'm sitting there, and I finally found one somewhere in the comp sci building, and I'm sitting there reading my email, and there's this guy sitting not far away who's kind of like keeps on looking at me, and finally like he gets up all of his courage and he says, "Wow, you're a girl." And I go, "Yeah." "And wow, you're reading your email. And I go, yeah. And the next line is something like, and wow, you don't shave your legs. And I'm going like, I think this guy's trying to pick me up. but it was an unusual thing for anyone to be reading email, and it was an unusual thing for a girl to be reading email at that point also. So yeah, it was, I didn't plan it that way at all. It sort of slipped into things, but it was a really interesting, circuitous thing. On the other hand, you know, I was surrounded by all of these people doing really interesting things, and I wanted to be part of that sort of atmosphere, but nothing that they were doing interested me. Like all the people at Xerox PARC are working on documents, and it's like, I'm not interested in documents. So it was really, you know, and you know, at MIT, at comp sci departments, they're usually talking about, you know, processor design, and I wasn't interested in processor design either. What did interest me was when Danny said, you know, we're doing this supercomputer, and it's going to cost at least $1 million. So, you know, just don't even think about how much the packaging costs. Just make it look drop dead incredible. So, as a 25-year-old product designer, you know, I got like I got carte blanche to do the most incredible packaging design I could think of. So. That maybe also led to my decision a couple of years later, when I knew the design was fixed and wouldn't change, to say, okay, I've kind of achieved the height of what I can achieve in this area. Let's go off and do something completely different. And I went to art school.
I gotcha. Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, the CM1 is just a striking design. I've heard you describe it as being, you know, a certain height. It didn't have to, so it wouldn't be imposing. It's friendly in an interesting way, because it's unlike any other computer. And we know technically it's not a computer. It's just a bunch of single bit processors.
It's extended memory. Extended intelligent memory. Yeah, but that was also really a design criteria from Danny. He said, make it, you know, it should be like your height or so, because then it'll, you know, for your generic white American male, it'll be slightly below eye height. And so, you know, we don't want to, of course, we all had things like HAL and 2001 in our A Space Odyssey in our heads. And, you know, building the first commercial AI supercomputer, Danny didn't want to have it be sort of the dreaded technical overlord that was the standard trope of science fiction. So that was really a really conscious decision on Danny's part to make it seem like it's, you know, a member of the family, a machine that can be proud of us.
And I cannot think of computers before it or after that have that, you know, that many LEDs that are doing.
Yeah.
And so how much of that is...
Oh, just a second. You do know that the LEDs are actually the status lamps for each processor chip.
Right.
So they're not, I mean, that's something that was lost in the CM5, which the follow-on machine that I did not work on, except for a 99th hour consulting. There it was literally, the LEDs were literally an add-on decorative panel to maintain that look. Again, that's sort of an industrial design thing, whereas it was really important to me on the CM1, CM2, that it was not a decorative add-on. It was really letting, you know, we made the doors transparent so you could see the life inside the machine. And I would have done that if they had hired me back to do the CM2, I would have done a similar thing in probably a rather different way on the CM5s, to let the life of the machine show through, to communicate that life to the people standing around.
You know, even then, people talk about, at least people, operators of mainframes with that would have not necessarily this scale of lamps, but you know, something like a PDP-10 or a KI-10
mm-hmm.
would have
right.
a bunch of lamps. And it's not that you're looking at exactly what those lamps are doing, but the sequence of patterns that you see. And you can, when you look at one of those machines, you see certain patterns and you kind of know what state it's in and what it's doing and when it's hung and when it's in a loop and
right.
when it's not running at all. So,
right, yeah.
So that carries into it, but gosh, it's a futuristic representation for sure. And it's done in a different way, but it's kind of like the last flourish of blinking lights, I would say, because
yeah.
like you said, in the CM5, the way they did it was just, it was Hollywood, so to speak. And guess what? That's the one that made it into Jurassic Park, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was also very big. You know, I'm not sure how tall each unit of the CM5 is, but they had to throw out the idea of keeping it small because it was just too big. I mean, it turns out, you know, at some point, my first job at Thinking Machines was, is it even physically possible to build this? And so, like, you know, I went through all the details and said, you know, well, it's going to be 10 foot tall, you know, with the specs that you gave me for how big the boards have to be and stuff. It's going to be 10 foot tall, and there's actually some material on my website showing those designs where it has really convoluted wiring, cabling. And so after I said that, they came back and said, well, I guess we're going to have to get inventive, and they reduced the number of cables coming off the board drastically. I can't remember now exactly what they did, but I think it was something about ganging up the power, maybe distributing the power differently. And then at that point, it became clear that we could actually put the machine in a 19-inch rack. So it could really be just like a normal computer, a normal washing, you know, refrigerator or whatever. So at that point, after that point, it was a marketing decision to go with a package that was different and somehow expressed the essence of the machine. But it was a really important marketing decision because we were all like, you know, 25, 26-year-olds. There were a couple of adults, as we called them, who were, you know, taking care of the finances and stuff, where the head of engineering was an adult. He was probably 40. But you know, Danny was, and I were like 25, 26, and many of the engineers, like Brewster Kahle, you might know him from the Internet Archive,
yeah.
but he did the VLSI design of the first connection machine chip. And he had just graduated with his master's, I think. I mean, he was like 22 or something like that, 21, 22. So, so here we were, this bunch of kids and, you know, IBM and, of course, Cray and DEC and all these other, and Fujitsu, all these other companies, you know, were being run by adults. And they were kind of like, why would you want to buy, you know, a computer built by a bunch of kids, you know, from a company that hasn't existed before? So it was very, very important that as soon as the people saw the machine, they grokked it, they grasped the concept. You didn't have to, like, explain to them because they just looked at the machine. And, you know, you could, like, lead them into the room and say, you've never seen a machine before this in your life, and it's got 64,000 processors all working simultaneously on the same problem. And then you lead them into the room, and then, you know, it's kind of dark, and all these machines are humming away and in the middle of the room because you can't back it up against the wall, is this big black electronic brain blinking away and humming away. And people just go, I get it, I get it. You're right, I've never seen a machine like this in my life. So, you know, that was the risk that Thinking Machines was willing to take, which another company might not have taken. They would have said, nah, you know, it's too expensive. We'll just like shove it into a 19-inch rack. But Thinking Machines knew they had to have some sort of immediate advantage when you showed a potential customer the machine for the very first time. They had to be convinced from the get-go.
And you're right. It does have to sit in the middle of the room. Cray was trying to do that too, to have sort of, but I think Cray is probably a little more imposing because there are no lights. It's just sitting there humming away. Much of the Cray computers and some of the CDC stuff that Seymour did don't use fans. So you'll hear the compressor system that's doing the cooling, you know, running the, so it's a different kind of hum. But I know the CM1 and CM2 were both air-cooled.
Yeah, both air-cooled, right.
Right.
And the Cray 2 was...
It's floor inert. So it has...
Yeah.
The Cray 2 has that iconic, I guess iconic you can call it, a waterfall with the... It just says Cray on it, that plexiglass. Those are... fairly contemporary, I'd say, the Connection Machine and the Cray.
The Cray 1 already existed at the point when I started working on the Connection Machine. So the Cray 1 was the only example that we had of a machine that was really striking and also whose design was really, was really driven by the necessity of the architecture. You know, every single wire in the Cray had to be the same length because the speed of light would cause problems. The speed of light is a constant, and if your wires are different lengths, the speed of light is the amount of time it takes to get there is different. So so that's why it had that rat's nest of wires.
Yeah, the point to point connections are kind of the signature of Seymour Cray, the drape,
right,
point-to-point wires, because the timing is so critical. And then,
right,
of course, in the Connection Machine, you have ribbon cables coming off the back of the back plane.
And right. And
the way that those were muxed.
Right. And some of those cables go, you know, really from, because the package was, when you opened it up, essentially formed a U. Some of those cables go from one end of the machine completely to the other. And so I think maybe in the CM2 and some versions of it that they were trying to increase running speed, that did sort of become a block. And so in the CM5, they might have gone to a very different wiring scheme. I actually don't know the wiring scheme of the CM5. But with the conceptual architecture of the CM1 and CM2 and the 12-dimensional hypercube, the concept was that the length was not a critical factor because you have to wait for all of the processors to finish their step anyway. They're all in lockstep.
Just described how you open up one of these things. Not exactly how to open it up. There's kind of a secret door. Then you have to loosen a couple of bolts, and then it kind of opens up into this U shape. And then there's a great picture of you in the middle of the machine, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah, looking over the top because you're taller than it is. Now, are you standing on your tippy toes or...
Yeah, it's I'm only like 1 inch taller than it, so it's my eye height is below the top of it, I have to peek over the top. I really have to get on my tippy toes.
In the design of it, how far did you get into it? I mean, aside from the, you know, the sliding door, the sliding plexiglass doors or the tinted red door. Are the doors tinted red? They are, aren't they?
They're actually, it was sort of a bronze plexiglass, and then there's a red translucent plastic foil on the back of each door in order to give it a redder cast, and then also sort of let the red of the lights show through. And those doors, I mean, they were hand sanded. I've never been able to find out in production how were they actually made, but I know that the prototype ones that Gordon Bruce and Al Hawthorne, the industrial designers that we hired to work with us on the machine, the ones that they produced were literally hand sanded and then sprayed with a Kevlar matte spray in order to reduce the reflection. And I swear to God, I've asked everyone I could find how they were made in production, and whoever knows that, I haven't found that person yet. So that's a problem when the Museum of Modern Art in New York, you know, talk about wanting to refurbish the doors because they're scratched, then it's like no one knows how it was done anymore except for this hand process, which also doesn't work because that matte spray is not made anymore.
Yeah.
So it's like a conservationist nightmare. So most people have said, okay, this is a real working machine. It's got scratches. Live with it, you know.
Yeah.
Show your wounds, as Joseph Beuys, the German artist, always said. Don't hide your wounds. Show your wounds.
You can either tell if a machine's been loved or if it's been stored in a barn for a number of years.
Yeah, and most machines at this point went through both.
Right.
Phases.
But one thing that I wanted to add that kind of got shot down was I said, you know, it's not just about the blinking lamps. You got to hear the fan as well.
Yes, yes. And that actually, because MoMA didn't do that. You know, everyone who worked at Thinking Machines who came to the MoMA opening said, you know, what's missing? All the fans, because they were like, you know, all these decks of fans, and they were like going constantly. So seriously, tell everyone else that you are absolutely right, that the noise of the fans is also an important part of it.
Wouldn't there have been, what is it, something like 18 fans per quadrant? Nine on the top and nine on the bottom. There might be more, actually.
Yeah,
because there's fan trays up above and below.
Right.
The cards or the boards.
And I think there were two in the, you know, in the wasp place middle. I think they were stacked two on top of each other. Below, I'm not sure. I think Gordon Bruce wrote an article on those sorts of details, and I might have a copy somewhere, but I haven't digitized it yet. But I could try and find that. Ted Bilodeau, who did the cooling design, at least in 2017, he was still alive, but having some problems, and he loved to talk about fans. So if you guys want to talk to him, I can send you his information. And he doesn't respond to email, but you can just call him and he'll, you know, and if he's still alive, he'll talk your ear off about fans.
Okay. Like many folks do, I know.
Yeah.
But
hold on just a second before I forget, because you said it only had like one cube worth of boards.
Yeah.
That was, basically a machine that was fully loaded with boards, and all eight cubes was pretty expensive, and they mostly went to the dark sites. So of course they, we have no record of that. But the most typical version had one tower, so two cubes filled with boards. And that was true of the MoMA machine. Yeah.
So you're saying the one at MoMA was potentially fully populated?
No. It was also only one tower, so a 16K machine.
I
see. So 64K is a full machine. Two towers, usually the front two towers is the 32K machine. One tower is the most common one sold, 16K. It's actually a little bit rare to have an 8K machine like you had in the large package, because at some point, a couple years later, they hired an industrial designer to make a one cube knockoff, which of course had a lot cheaper package. So
that would be cute. A tripping hazard, but that would be cute.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was maybe not on the ground. It was maybe on a desk. But that was called the 2A, CM2A.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's really interesting, because that particular machine, it's like there is so much open space inside of it.
Yeah.
You know, because why put the backplanes in? You know, they possibly could be field installed later if the customer wanted to upgrade. But... that one is mostly empty.
So, I think part of it was that they were hoping people would upgrade, or most people hoped that they could upgrade, whether or not that ever happened. It was also because of like cooling and power considerations that at some point they said, okay, we're going to just ship with the main package. I mean, you know, there was never a version that was a 16K machine, one tower. It was always either the 8K machine in the CM2A little package, or if it had more than eight, then it was always in the full CM1, CM2 package.
Yeah, and we noticed that's important, because when you're trying to move it and take it apart, it becomes a tipping hazard. So it really needs to be in that form, and then you open it as a U for maintenance or whatever you need to do.
More stable, yeah.
Yeah, it is definitely much more stable to keep it in that sort of opening, closing. Do you know how many CM1s/CM2s were made?
CM1s is a small handful. I actually don't know an exact number. I'm guessing maybe around 32. I've sort of collated all the dimensions that I've been able to find, but you know, they got like resold and the black site machines were never counted anyway. And you know, Danny says they shipped the machine to Italy and it disappeared, and they figure it probably actually was transshipped over Italy to Russia. You know, so it's a real floating number. I did have a figure of a total of 70 installations worldwide, but an installation can range from, you know, we've got an 8K CM2A to we've got a CM5 and a CM2 and a data vault. And the 70 installations worldwide definitely included CM5s. So my best guess is somewhere around like 30.
Attention on radio listeners. Coming up at 0300 hours UTC is a Penmic package with open mic. Anyone can stream.
I got a question for you. Were you disappointed when the CM5 was showed up in Jurassic Park?
So the CM2 was pretty old at that point. I understand marketing. I understand why they want to show the the, you know, the very impressive current one. The CM2 was in the Fly 2. The film The Fly had was a series of two movies, and there's images where you can see it in the second one. Jurassic Park, the book, actually talked about having a cray. And so the fact that it's a CM instead of a cray is actually a huge coup for thinking machines.
That is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I can't describe to you what that half year was like in 2016 to 2017 from you know, the first email of the from the MoMA curator saying, you know, we'd like to acquire one, do you know of any, to the point where she told me, okay, it's been approved. It's like I had to find one. I didn't know if I could find one that was actually for sale, and I was just sweating blood for half a year, because you know, this was my baby.
Yeah.
And I've seen ones that have been trashed, you know, and it's and of course, you know, of course there's like, you know, there's one in the Smithsonian, and there was one in the Computer History Museum, but you know, none of them are interested in the product design of the thing. And I knew if I got it into the Museum of Modern Art, it was because of the design. So that was, you know, specifically about, you know, my part of the connection machine. So I was sweating blood, and you know, sure enough, like the year I turned 60 was the year that I got into the museum. So that was amazing. It's like after that, it's like, okay, I can die happy.
Okay, that was it. That's part one.
That was amazing.
Oh, yes, it was absolutely amazing. Holy cow. I did not expect that to be so much fun. And,
yeah.
And that is only part one. So that, for the most part, covers the connection machine up to its use in a MoMA art exhibit in Wing Luke here in Seattle. So MoMA, of course, in New York City.
Yes.
The next part is going to be covering her work in augmented reality. And one thing I did not know about that we experienced during VCF was Neo Habitat.
Yes.
And she was not involved in Neo Habitat. However, she was involved in something that Steven Spielberg did.
Yeah, so a future project that involved VR or augmented reality for children that were...
with disabilities.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, all sorts, for children's hospitals, basically,
right,
to allow them to have a virtual space to play.
Right.
And so it's an incredible study, actually, of how augmented reality can serve, you know, human needs.
Sure.
In particular ways. And so I found that very interesting. So I said, we should have a follow-up call, and let's just talk about augmented reality. I mean, you know, we can talk about virtual reality, too, but
right, augmented reality, yeah.
Yeah, it's still an interesting idea, and it's still very exploratory right now, although there are practical uses.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, like, especially with COVID.
Attention on radio
reality,
listeners. Coming up at 0300 hours UTC is a Penwick
well,
with open,
you know,
mic. Anyone can stream.
Very pedestrian, boring. Let's go to IKEA and get a whole bunch of furniture and figure out how it fits in our 10x15, you know, den or something like
sure,
that.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah, and being able to walk through that, you know, with whatever dongle
right,
you have over your eyes.
Right, and the other thing that I always thought was interesting about AR versus VR was that, rather than attempt to be, totally immersive, mm-hmm. it becomes sort of part of your actual, your actual environment. It's sort of an addition to, often.
Yeah, certainly, and it, some of the examples I've seen, because I've been to a few AR, AR fairs or something like
uh-huh.
that, but they weren't necessarily open to the public. These were ones that were
internal trade shows or something like that, or
connected to Seattle Art Fair and things like that. Mm-hmm. It was sort of like a preview gallery where you didn't want to have a wide audience, but you still wanted to have...
Right, you wanted to get some feedback from people in general.
I thought, one of the things that I thought was really cool, and I don't like horror games at all. I don't play those kind of video games, but
sure.
I certainly can react like a prey animal if if I'm put in that position. And so, I donned the little headset or whatever, and I could see the room that I was in, but then I could also see the objects that were imposed upon the room by AR. And, they were tearing in the room and they were coming to get me type thing.
Yeah.
So, that kind of thing is is interesting, too. So,
your nightmares are now fully visualized.
Right. It's like, hey, am I awake? Am I asleep? Am I awake? Oh, I got to go back to sleep. Who knows?
Yeah.
Were there any questions that you had or anything that you wanted to follow up that maybe weren't covered? I thought it was pretty thorough.
I thought she was pretty good about kind of covering all the bases on that. Especially I liked that she went into the difference between product design and industrial design.
Yeah.
Because, we often kind of lump that stuff together today.
Right. Yeah, and she clarifies that was a different thing. And I didn't get a chance to ask her specifically what she worked on at Hewlett-Packard in the late 70s.
That might be something to follow up on. Any other interesting projects that she may have worked on that might be possibly notable or, things that might be well-known, but, maybe she was part of a design team and therefore...
Right.
We don't know
who is specifically
responsible for these things.
Yeah, and just a week ago or so, there was an art forum for Seattle Art Fair that I attended that there was a curator from the SAM and some other groups. And one of the things that has become a big issue, especially with digital art and mixed media art, is that do you deal with the rendered object as the art form, or do you take the tools that are used to render it?
Yeah.
And so there's some back and forth of that.
Yeah, I know. I could see that there's a place for both, really, that, that the person who experiences, the art probably mm-hmm. has one thing, but, the tools in and of themselves are kind of... Yeah, the art is actually really an extension of the tools, right?
Yeah, and then when does the artist lose control of what they've produced? And so, and the example was, if somebody rendered an image in 1998, the resolution would be such that if you tried to display it today, it would just be incredibly pixelated, and it might even be a completely different piece. For someone to experience. So,
this is where we can bring our friend Froggy Me into the conversation. Whereas I was getting a little grouchy with him during VCF, but this is sort of a valid
attention on radio listeners. Coming up at 0300
CRT
hours UTC is a pandemic with open mic. Anyone
sort of their
can stream.
Own aesthetic qualities that is somewhat lost.
Yeah. They kind of dither and blend in a way that that LCDs or plasmas might just contrast so sharply that they distort you know, even the highest resolution of the original artist's intent. So it's this is kind of like the conservator's dilemma. It's like, do we preserve this Amiga 500 that produced this RGB image that's, you know,
right,
less than 1024 by 768? And how do we display it on our 8K, you know, plasma displays? Are we going to show it at full resolution, which is going to be a tiny dot in the middle of the screen?
Right. Do we interpolate? Add all sorts of things to the image that were never intended to be added? And then what does
right.
that say about...
upscaling. Yeah.
Yeah.
and so, one of the questions was, okay, well, if we conserve the Amiga 500 and then we use that to, maybe it takes, you know, 5 days of rendering instead of 1 day, you know, to produce the product or produce the artwork, do we use that to produce a higher resolution, one that we can display in 2020? So, yeah, it's what's Bronzy Me say? Sorry, Bronzy Me.
Yeah.
You confused me with Froggy Me and Bronzy Me. Bronzy 94 says, do nothing. Nothing? Do both. Oh, he meant
both.
Do both.
Yeah, I think that's basically the alternative is to do both, preserve both,
mm-hmm.
and do so as long as possible.
Right, and then you run into like a Hall of Mirrors situation where it's like an endless thing. It's like, oh, how many times do we have to render this thing for this thing? It's like, yeah. It's real difficult. I mean, for things that are printed media, that's a different thing because you can at least print it and then you're preserving it against
right.
UV and things like that. If it's something that's being displayed on a CRT, like a Sony Trinitron, right?
Yep.
4x3, and then...
And those caps aren't getting any younger.
Right. So it's really interesting. And then at some point... For the artist, it could be like you were cutting edge, but now you're retro because you're on the Sony Trinitron versus the latest and greatest LCD projectors or whatever.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it's really interesting because never has, especially with digital mixed media, like never has art and technology been so close to being important to each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And so
it's not brushes and pigments anymore, right?
Well, or sorry, I'm not going to be crass about other matter being used in artwork. Sorry. This is a family show. So what do we have? It is.
It counts as pigment.
We have. We've got a minute 30. So what do you want to say? So
So there's been some murmuring about the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest.
Oh,
I think we are going to have a digital experience.
Woo-hoo!
At some point.
Right.
I don't know how it's going to actually come to be. I don't know if it's going to be just a bunch of presented clips or if it's going to be fully interactive, but we shall see. And then another curious thing came over the email today, and that is the organizers are trying to decide whether or not they want to print some t-shirts for the show that never was.
Oh, I see. maybe
so,
as a fundraiser.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, feed money for next year, right?
Well, we have 30 seconds left, and I just want to say, everybody that's listening, tune in next week, Thursday, 0200 hours UTC for Vintage Comp. We'll be back here. Right, Jazzmas?
Absolutely.
It's been fun. Thank you so much. This
yeah,
will
thank
be
you so
in,
much.
Yeah, it'll be in the non-radio archive. So there you go.
Great.
Oops,
thanks a lot.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.